Such an honor to be here. And I wanted to thank my family and my friends who are here for many years of really spiritual support and guidance. I just couldn't ever do any of this without you. Many of you have had long conversations with me about many issues, so thank you. Our scripture reading this morning comes from Matthew chapter 20, verses 1 through 16. And this is the parable of the workers in the vineyard, which Jesus tells in response to Peter asking what reward the apostles will get for following Jesus. So let us hear God's word. For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire workers for his vineyard. And he agreed to pay them a denarius for the day, and he sent them into his vineyard. About 9 in the morning, he went out, and he saw others standing in the marketplace doing nothing. And he told them, "You also go and work in my vineyard, and I will pay you whatever's right." So they went. He went out again about noon and about 3 in the afternoon and did the same thing. About 5 in the afternoon, he went out, and he found still others standing around. He asked them, "Why have you been standing here all day long doing nothing?" "Because no one has hired us," they answered. He said to them, "You also go and work in my vineyard." Now when the evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, "Call the workers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last ones hired and going on to the first." The workers who were hired about 5 in the afternoon came, and each received a denarius. So when those came who were hired first, they expected to receive more. But each one of them also received a denarius. When they received it, they began to grumble against the landowner. "These who were hired last worked only 1 hour," they said, "and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the work and the heat of the day." But he answered one of them, "I'm not being unfair to you, friend. Didn't you agree to work for a denarius? Take your pay and go. I want to give the one who was hired last the same as I gave you. Don't I have the right to do what I want with my own money? Or are you envious because I am generous?" So the last will be first, and the first will be last. May God bless the reading of his word. Now, I love this parable because it's such a simple story, and yet it's so profound. For those of you who were here last week, I got a little nervous when Laura started speaking about the prodigal son because she started to get into some of what I'm going to talk about. But by the grace of God, she left me a lot of material. And I've written and rewritten this so many times already. There's just so much packed in here that I had a hard time focusing on one aspect that I could cover in 20 to 30 minutes. And if there's one thing I've learned from preaching, it's that I need to cut these things down. And Paul's assured me that he's going to give me more opportunities, so I don't need to get everything out today like I've felt compelled to do in the past when I've kept you here for a 30 or 40 minute sermon. So I apologize for that in the past. So this parable is about work, it's about reward, it's about faith. It's about faith that you'll get paid. He doesn't even tell the later workers what he's going to pay them. He says, "I'm going to pay you what's right." It's about fairness and economics, each of which could be a sermon in itself. I want to focus on how we measure our value in comparison to others. Now, the natural reaction to this parable is, that's not fair. That's not how the labor market works. Employers don't just gratuitously pay the same rate for less work. That's not what I learned in economics. But this is one of those parables, like many, many others, that's designed to turn our human value system upside down. And the line that captures that notion best is the concluding sentence. The last will be first, and the first will be last. What on earth does that mean? It's not just a throwaway line. I've heard people say that they don't agree with the parable, that it irritates them. If that's your reaction, my advice is to examine why that is. I mean, this is Jesus, folks. It's not like this is Paul or some obscure disciple talking here who you could maybe disagree with. This is Jesus. And it challenges us to question the way we look at what's right and fair if we want to live in peace and fulfillment. The reason Jesus taught in parables was to cause deep, deep thinking and make the message, which is often counterintuitive, memorable about moral truth. And they're most often not what they appear to be on the surface. And this one in particular pushes us to question the ways that we as human beings have organized the world with our notions of how we measure value and worth, how we should distribute scarce resources, and who should be rewarded for what. Before we dive into what this is saying about how we measure our and others' value, let me just say a few things about the context of the story. First, vineyards. Vineyards are notoriously finicky. It's not easy to predict when the harvest will be. The grapes grow all summer, and there's not a lot to do during that time. But come fall, when the weather begins to turn and the grapes are starting to get plump and full of juice, a lot can go wrong. If there's suddenly a lot of rain, or it becomes unpredictably hot, or a frost descends on the vineyard, the grapes can turn from optimal to unusable very quickly. And that's why the vintage is so important with fine wine, as Perry knows. The vintage on the bottle is the year that the grapes were harvested, not when it was bottled. Now, the landowner here is monitoring his vineyard to identify the day when his grapes have become optimal for harvesting. And he needs to do a lot of labor very quickly. So he keeps going out over the course of the day to get enough laborers to harvest all of the grapes by the end of the day. Okay, second point of context, the denarius. This was the standard Roman silver coin of the day. It was a common day's wage for a rank and file soldier or for an unskilled laborer. And when the landowner offers a denarius to the first group of workers, he's not trying to take advantage of them. This is what they would likely be paid by any vintner or landowner. Third, the kingdom of heaven. The parable begins by saying that the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire workers for his vineyard. The kingdom of heaven is not some place where we go when we die. When Jesus talks about the kingdom of heaven, he's talking about a way of life now, on earth. He's talking about living in contentment, as we heard in a three-part series from Paul last month. He's talking about living in peace and fulfillment and purpose and meaning. He's talking about how we live our best lives now. Final point of context, the work. The opportunity to live in that kingdom of heaven requires that you answer the call to work. It's not easy. In fact, it's a path of hard sweat labor of service. Living in peace and contentment is not a walk in the park. It requires discipline, moral certitude, and opening yourself up to what is offered by God every day. And that isn't easy. It's a whole other sermon, but it's an important theme here. Okay, a little bit of context just on the last line. So Matthew is the only book of the gospel where this parable occurs, but it's not the only place where Jesus says in words or substance, the last will be first and the first will be last. That line also appears in Mark and Luke. So it must be something really important. In Matthew, Jesus tells this parable after Peter says to Jesus, "We've left everything to follow you. What then will there be for us?" Peter is operating in this economic system of risk and reward, where the greater the risk, that is giving up everything, the greater the potential reward. And Jesus tells this parable to convey to Peter that the kingdom of heaven, our best possible life, doesn't operate by our earthly paradigms and systems. It doesn't operate by Darwinian principles of survival of the fittest. All the things we try to use as measurements of human beings and the value of human life, they're of no moment if you want to live in heaven on earth. Okay, so that's the preview and the context and the background. Now let's turn to the psychology of the early workers. The early workers grumbled when they were paid the same as the later workers. They were dissatisfied because they had borne the, quote, burden of the work in the heat of the day. It didn't matter to them that they'd been paid exactly what they had been promised and what they had bargained for. What they cared about was that what they were paid was less than what the others had been paid in comparison to the work that had been provided. They would have been happy with their wages had the other workers never come, because it was what they had expected to earn. It was only when they saw what the others were getting paid that they felt ripped off. They became resentful because they thought they had not been paid fairly. They became resentful not because they thought they had been paid unfairly, but because someone else seemed more fortunate than they were. Now that's interesting. That resonates with me. I don't know about you, but I can see that in my own life. I get that reaction. It's probably how I would have felt. It's a totally natural reaction. We're thrilled if we get a 10% raise, only until we learn that a coworker got a 15% raise. After studying 14 hours straight for a final exam, we're elated when we get an A, until we learn that the guy who crammed 1 hour before the exam also got an A. We have this tendency to measure ourselves in relative terms based on how much of our limited resources we've accumulated in comparison to others around us. Money, for example, is one of those limited resources. And it's one of the most obvious measurements that we use to size people up, including ourselves. We use it as a proxy for success, intelligence, influence, talent, and power. When talking about someone who's made a lot of money, how often do you hear that person described as, quote unquote, successful? Money is just one of those heuristics that we use for determining whether a person might be useful to me, whether it's someone I want to get to know or someone I want to be close to. And like money, we use power and influence and status and fame as heuristics. We're drawn to it and to people who have it because our instinct tells us these are people who are valuable. And our natural instinct tells us to avoid those who don't have it. The uneducated, the sick, the addicts, the homeless, the incarcerated, those we have no use for. Certainly no use in our survival. And the way we use these metrics to measure ourselves and others is to think in terms of how much do I have relative to others. That's how our economic system works. Doesn't matter how much money or resources you have. What matters is how much you have relative to everyone else. It's a zero-sum game. When Jesus refers to the first and last, those are relative terms. First in comparison to whom? Last in comparison to whom? First and last are relative. Those terms are only meaningful in comparison to another event. So when he says first will be last and last will be first, he's saying your ways of measuring your worth as relative to others are not relevant concepts when we live as he does. Heaven on earth is a different paradigm. It doesn't matter one whit whether you're the wealthiest, the most powerful, the most famous on the human scale of value. Now, those things don't preclude you from living in heaven on earth. They might be a distraction from God's grace, but at bottom, they're just not relevant if you aren't able to recognize and live in God's grace. My good friend Don Burton, who's here today, sent me a great article in the Atlantic Monthly about how to want less. It's by Arthur C. Brooks. Many of you may have heard about him. He's an essayist. He focuses on human happiness. He teaches at Harvard. And in that article, he writes, "When we think about satisfaction from success, or possessions, or fitness, or good looks, there's another element to consider. Success is relative. Satisfaction requires not just that you continuously run in place on your own hedonic treadmill, but that you run slightly faster than other people are running on theirs. This is why people, this is Brooks's quote, this is why people with hundreds of millions of dollars can feel like failures if their friends are billionaires, and why famous Hollywood actors can be despondent that others are even more famous." The MIT cognitive scientist, many of you may have heard about, his name is Steven Pinker, he writes that people feel happy when they're better off than their neighbors, unhappy when they feel worse. He writes, "People today are safer, healthier, better fed, longer lived than any time in history. Yet we don't spend our lives walking on air, and presumably our ancestors were not chronically glum." Author Gore Vidal is quoted as having said, "It's not enough to succeed. Others must fail." And there's a Yiddish saying, "When does a hunchback rejoice? When he sees one with a larger hump." Now, the hedonic treadmill that Brooks is referring to has its roots in Aristotle and his work called Nicomachean Ethics, where Aristotle distinguishes between hedonic and eudaimonic well-being. Hedonic well-being is sensory-based happiness, while eudaimonic well-being is moral-based happiness. Aristotle rightly observed that hedonic pursuits don't lead to long-term happiness in the way that eudaimonic pursuits do. The hedonic treadmill, or hedonic adaptation theory as it's called, is that as we make more money or acquire new possessions, we have this initial sense of happiness or satisfaction, but it quickly dissipates because we then adjust to our expectations and our desires to want more relative to what we have, and we revert to a relatively stable level of happiness. The hedonic treadmill is the never-ending quest for satisfaction and happiness that we never achieve because we're looking for it in the wrong places. Money, possessions, vacations, power, influence, fame. We never achieve it there because once we get those things, we discover that they still don't give us the peace and security that we expected. And we figure we just need to get a little bit more to get there. That's why it's a treadmill, because we keep running, but we don't get anywhere. It's like the Rolling Stones song, where Mick, have you ever invoked Mick Jagger? Invoked Mick Jagger up here?
Invoked, never.
Okay. It's like the Rolling Stones song, where Mick Jagger sings, "I try, and I try, and I try, and I try, but I can't get no satisfaction." I can't take credit for that. That was in the article. But I will continue with the lyrics because they're meaningful, and those weren't in the article. He says, "When I'm driving in my car, when a man comes on the radio, he's telling me more and more about some useless information supposed to fire my imagination. When I'm watching my TV and a man comes on and he tells me how white my shirts can be, but he can't be a man because he doesn't smoke the same cigarettes as me." That's the hedonic treadmill. That's what he's singing about. And Brooks tells us that our natural survival instinct is to measure ourselves in relation to where others are on their hedonic treadmills. And Mick Jagger just captures that beautifully in Satisfaction. And this instinct to measure our value relative to others is reinforced every hour of every day. We are obsessed with our rankings, as if these things actually matter to a life of fulfillment. We love our magazines that rank people and places based on money and influence and prestige. Forbes ranks the richest people in the world and all the top places I'm supposed to visit before I die. U.S. News ranks our best colleges. Time magazine ranks the most influential people in the world. And Money magazine ranks the best places to live. We're caught up in a very real mental health crisis in America, particularly among our young people. Why are we surprised or shocked by that when, as Mick Jagger observes, the most powerful commercial forces prey on our natural human instinct to put value only on that which can be measured relative to others? Advertisers love this. They love that our natural human instinct is to emulate the rich, the powerful, the famous. They love that we measure ourselves in relation to others. They love that our evolutionary biology is to want to outrun and out-earn others. That instinct is what causes us to seek meaning and fulfillment in the wrong places, the places where we will never find it and are left in despair because we don't know where else to look. Okay, that's all the bad news. The place to look is actually right in front of us. Bad news is we ignore it. Back to the parable. The beauty of the gospel and Jesus is that they're as relevant today as they were 2,000 years ago. We have different ways of explaining truth in the human condition, but the gospel makes the same observations about the hurdles to living our best lives, the traps set for us, and the means of avoiding them. That's why the gospel is sacred. It's this font of insight that we can keep going back to time and again, and it remains relevant because it speaks to universal human truth. The parable tells us the bad news and the good news. The bad news is that it illustrates what happens when we're left to our own devices and the traps we fall into. When we rely on our instinct without the guidance from God to decide right from wrong, fair and unfair, worthy and unworthy, and the value of one another. When we set up the measures by which to determine worth, it tells us that without God, we're left with dissatisfaction, angst, unrest, and the endless trot going nowhere on our hedonic treadmills. You can increase the speed on the treadmill to outrun the guy next to you, but you're still going nowhere. You're just going to get there faster. The good news is that this parable offers us a different paradigm where our value isn't measured by how much of our limited earthly resources we have. If you want to live in heaven on earth, a life of peace and meaning and fulfillment, you need to internalize a completely different frame of mind where our value isn't measured by how much we have in relation to others. Our fate is not to regress to our natural instinct. We can choose to recognize the danger in relying on our ways of measuring value and accept what Jesus is offering, which is a new way of life where we live for a different purpose. And that purpose is to transcend our instinct and identify what God is providing, which is access to what is unlimited. What God provides is love and beauty and awe, peace and connectedness. Those are things that don't come from us. They don't arise in our biological instinct. That's one of the reasons, frankly, that I have such a strong conviction about the existence of God. Where do you think these things in the human experience come from? Us? Not in my mind. God is the source from which love and beauty and awe and peace and meaning and moral truth manifest in the human experience. And those, my friends, are not scarce resources. They're unlimited, and they're good, and they're available to all, and not measured in relation to how much one person has versus another. I don't think you'll find a publication that ranks the top 25 most loving people. I mean, maybe there's some weird new agey type publication that does it, but No matter how strong the gravitational grip of our evolutionary instinct, Jesus gives us a way of life that allows us to transcend it and live now in heaven on earth. We have a choice, even though it requires a lot of work. The parable tells us we all have the ability to get a denarius at the end of the day. It tells the early workers, don't worry, you'll get what you were promised. It's just that it will be given to all who come. And my friends, take joy when all have it. Amen.